Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Politics and money. Experts say a campaign fully funded by public dollars could take candidates' attention away from raising money and get it focused on talking to voters.
If you can knock on 50 doors a night instead of making fundraising calls, that's a big difference.
Also this week, both Florida and the federal government release competing estimates on what Floridians can expect to pay next year for health insurance. Some think both groups are missing the mark.
The primary factor in determining what a family pays or what individual pays is their income and the plan that they choose. And those things will not change.
We'll also learn the latest from the abandoned North Florida Reform School, where the bodies of boys who died decades ago are being identified. We'll also find out why Florida lawmakers returned to Tallahassee this week. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Florida offers public funds to help statewide candidates pay for their campaigns. And Regan McCarthy reports while some have chosen to accept that money, others have turned it down, citing either personal qualms or a desire to raise more than the public funding caps would allow.
Running a campaign in Florida is expensive, especially if that campaign is for a statewide office, like governor or attorney general. The last time around, in 2010, Florida Governor Rick Scott spent $72 million of his own dollars to cinch the seat. And that's why gubernatorial candidate Nan Rich says she's decided to accept the public funds offered by the state to help candidates pay for their campaigns.
I think that it levels the playing field to some degree. It enables people that don't have, personally wealthy, aren't incumbents, don't have, a lot of people that they can contact that are, very wealthy. So it gives people an opportunity to participate.
Rich is squaring off against former Governor Charlie Crist in the Democratic gubernatorial primary. Crist raised $3.5 million just last month. And Scott's combined fundraising total for the month of July is just shy of $11 million. That's compared to the $986,000 in contributions Rich has received since the start of her campaign. But that is enough to make Rich eligible for $189,000 from public funds. And Rich says since the program works something like a matching grant, that's just the start of what she'll get as she continues to raise her own money. But she adds she's not counting on just money.
My campaign, as I've told people, since I really got into it, it's the difference is that my campaign is a grassroots campaign, and I'm focusing on voters.
And Bernard College political science professor Michael Miller says that can be one of the benefits of public campaign assistance programs. They can change the focus of a person's campaign.
Really, it's about the time, not so much the money. We have to give candidates back the ability to interact with voters, to make the calls.
Miller says besides helping candidates increase personal interaction with voters, states that have public funding programs can also see increased voter turnout. But he says that's only in states that offer full public funding for campaigns. Miller says Florida offers only partial funding.
I have not been able to detect in my own work, nor am I aware of any other existing work, that shows significant impacts of partial funding programs on any variable that political scientists are interested in, namely electoral competition.
Miller says while partial funding might help some candidates like Rich feel like they have more time to interact with the voters, it doesn't get rid of the need to fundraise, since in states like Florida, the amount of money a candidate receives from the public is based on how much they've earned. And that can end up helping incumbents. In each of the cabinet races, the sitting incumbents have collected hundreds of thousands of dollars from the state, while their lesser-known opponents have collected none. In some cases, that's because those candidates haven't raised enough money of their own to be eligible for the state money. In other cases, it's because those candidates didn't opt in. Florida's Democratic candidate for chief financial officer, Will Rankin, is one example. While he's short of the minimum amount of money needed to be eligible for the funds, he says he also didn't apply to get the money.
The primary reason is that, obviously, while I knew about it, it's just actually something that I feel very strongly about. I do not believe that it is appropriate for the people of Florida to be having to pay inadvertently for a political campaign.
So far, Rankin has received about $33,000 in contributions, a big chunk of which is his own money. His opponent, Republican incumbent Jeff Atwater, is easily outpacing him with more than $3 million in contributions so far. But Atwater's campaign manager, Brian Hughes, says the public funds the CFO is eligible for will help him run a better campaign.
Campaigning in Florida to 19 million people, about 12 million voters, I think, across some of the nation's most expensive media markets, were both geographically large and very expensive to run political campaigns.
And Hughes says whether to accept those funds is up to each individual candidate. Neither Crist nor Scott's campaigns made themselves available to answer questions for this story. Both did send statements attacking their opponents. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Florida insurance officials expect the cost of health insurance plans sold on a federal exchange to increase by an average of 13% next year. But not everyone agrees price hikes will be that steep. As Lynn Hatter tells us, critics are questioning the state's methods for calculating the increases.
The state's estimated 13.2% health insurance rate increase is receiving pushback from Affordable Care Act advocates, who say it's another example of the state's resistance to the federal health law.
The reality is, for most of the folks who use the marketplace, those rate increases that we see or hear about aren't going to apply to them personally.
Greg Mello is the policy director for the healthcare advocacy group Florida Chain, and he argues the way the state calculated health insurance pricing for the upcoming year is misleading.
It's just an analysis. The marketplace will still be working. The primary factor in determining what a family pays or what individual pays is their income and the plan that they choose. And those things will not change, despite the fact that the examples that OIR chose are not representative of the vast majority of the people who will be doing that purchasing.
Florida's analysis shows an individual making about $27,000 a year who qualifies for a federal subsidy would pay around $200 a month for their insurance. For example, according to the state, a single person in Leon County pays $166 a month for subsidized health insurance. That would increase by $37 next year.
Just as the former elected insurance commissioner of Florida 15 years ago, if I didn't think a rate hike was justified, I would cut it.
Florida U.S. Senator Bill Nelson is also critical of the Florida Office of Insurance Regulations math. During a stop in Tallahassee to endorse North Florida congressional candidate Gwen Graham, Nelson said the state abdicated its duty to regulate insurance rates.
The state legislature, signed by the governor, took away that power of the insurance commissioner. So is it any wonder that the health insurance companies are jacking their rates up now?
OIR used an average of all the mid-level silver plans sold on the exchange to come up with an average rate hike for consumers. More than 70% of the people who purchased their health insurance from the federal exchange purchased a silver plan. But the federal government is saying costs for most Floridians will go down, and it's basing its analysis on population centers and the fact that most people purchased cheaper silver plans. A June report from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services says most of the 984,000 people who signed up qualified for federal subsidies and are paying $68 a month for health insurance. Regardless of whether costs are going up or down, at least one thing is certain: Floridians will have more choices when it comes to insurance companies.
We do expect to offer a wide array of quality, innovative products that offer greater value and access and service to all Florida residents, regardless of their situation and life stages.
Elizabeth Cadillo Fiallo is the spokeswoman for health insurance giant United Healthcare, one of three companies entering Florida's insurance exchange market. United is gearing up to offer its products on the federal exchange after sitting out the first year. The company wanted to wait and see how the exchange would pan out before getting involved. And Fiallo says it had always been in the plan that United would participate.
You know, we're just making good on that promise that we are, you know, moving forward with a broader participation, and it's not only in Florida, but elsewhere as well.
So the bottom line, some Floridians will pay more for their health insurance, some will pay less. It depends on where you live, how old you are, and how much money you make. To find out what your costs will be, you'll have to wait until open enrollment on the Federal Insurance Exchange resumes. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, as one family got some answers surrounding the notorious former Dozier School for Boys this week, others remain hopeful their time will come.
I'm very encouraged with the process, and I'm hoping that the next discovery will be one that can give our family some peace and closure.
Years after the BP oil disaster, officials along the Florida Gulf Coast are still waiting for promised compensation.
We clearly told them we needed the money for the planning. If they want restoration, we need to have planning done so that we can do the proper projects.
A coastal town trying to rebound after the oyster industry's decline is home to a new craft beer brewery. And the Florida Capitol is again crawling with lawmakers, but what does that mean for the Tallahassee economy?
We have not seen very much pick up at all. We've had a few reservations trickle in toward the end of the week.
The recent identification of the first set of remains of a boy buried on the property of the now-closed Dozier School for Boys in Marianna has helped bring one family closer to closure, some 70 years after the death. And as Sasha Cordner reports, it's also helping to keep hope alive for other families awaiting similar answers.
Ordinarily, anybody who knows me know that I'm never at a shortage to talk. But I have to say that when Aaron came to visit me and she revealed to me that they had found my brother, I was totally dumbstruck.
It's been more than a week since 85-year-old Ovell Krell heard the news from lead University of South Florida researcher Aaron Kimmerly that the remains of her brother, 14-year-old George Owen Smith, have been identified. It's the first big step Kimmerly and her team have now taken to help bring closure to families looking for answers into their loved ones, believed to be buried on the grounds of the Dozier School for Boys, the former Panhandle Reform School surrounded by a history of alleged physical and sexual abuse. In January, Kimmerly's team announced the discovery of the remains of 55 bodies so far, more than previously thought by the state. Krell is one of nine families that have come forward so far to give their DNA in the hopes of finding a positive match. Krell is the first, a moment she says she never thought to see in her lifetime.
I couldn't believe it after 73 and a half years of fighting and looking and hoping and praying, and I was searching for him, not only out my love, but for a vow that I had made my mother and father on their deathbeds, that I would find my brother if it was in my power. I would look till I died. Well, I'm not dead, but there was times I wondered if after this many years I was going to find him before I did, because Mother Nature has a way of getting you.
Researcher Kimmerly says the circumstances surrounding Owen's death are still a mystery. His last known location after corresponding with his family via letters was Dozier. The family was later notified that Owen's body was mysteriously found under a house and later taken back by the school. According to Krell, the family was told he was buried on the grounds of Dozier at an unmarked grave, but they never knew if it was true.
We see from the remains of his shallow burial an unclothed boy pinned in a shroud, lying on his side along the edge of his grave. It was a hasty burial. We believe that such practices should not be endorsed by the passage of time, and that continued inaction on the part of those who have knowledge and the capacity to act.
That's Kimmerly speaking during a recent press conference about the official announcement. Now Kimmerly says after finding those answers, Krell's story is an inspiring one.
Ovell teaches us that it's never too late for courage and that we have everything when we have hope. It is our hope that this is the first of many identifications to come. Through the next year, as we continue to work with state leaders to address this dark chapter of our history, we hope to restore justice and continue to find resolution for all of the families that are still searching for answers, such as Glenn Varnado, who's also with us today.
Glenn Varnado is one of the first people to come forward looking for clues into his uncle's fate. He says, like Krell's brother, his uncle, 13-year-old Thomas Varnado, died under, quote, suspicious circumstances in 1934, and he was last seen by Glenn's father on the Dozier grounds. Still, he says he's very encouraged by the news of Krell and her brother.
I was happy to see that, we had been able to make a positive ID of at least one of the 55 bodies that have been unearthed so far. So that gives me hope that maybe one of the next 54 could possibly be my uncle.
And he says it's also encouraging for another reason.
Very encouraging because George Owen Smith was a Caucasian. He was found buried in Boot Hill, which was prior considered the black cemetery. But it's obviously a cemetery. I don't know if it's the only cemetery, but it certainly is a cemetery that blacks and whites are both buried in. So hopefully my Uncle Thomas will be in that same area.
As for Krell, she says while she's still very thankful and remains hopeful other families will get similar relief, it's been a rough week. With finding the remains of her older brother, her baby brother just passed away, which she says kind of put everything into perspective.
And maybe this helped us realize the importance of all of this. But it's been a rough week for us, but we're pretty strong people. And we're just thankful we got one blessing, and then we lost a brother who had been very ill, and this, in a way, is a blessing also.
Meanwhile, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, as well as the Florida Cabinet, have agreed to extend the USF research team's permit to continue their work for another year. The state is also working on a plan for the reburial of anyone identified. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
In the wake of 2010's BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, coastal areas affected by the tragedy were promised billions of dollars in compensation. As Bob Barrett with member station WUWF in Pensacola reports, the refrain remains, the money's coming. Someday.
Although we are still probably years away from knowing exactly how much money BP will be required to pay because of the spill, there's already a pot of $625 million in fines from a settlement with a subcontractor to BP called Transocean waiting to be distributed. Florida's senior Senator Bill Nelson says that money has already been collected.
That money is ready to flow as soon as the Treasury Department and the Office of Management and Budget issues their regulations.
And according to Senator Nelson, those regulations, which are mandated by the Restore Act, may be just around the corner.
They are trying to get those regulations, and this is the news, trying to get those regulations out no later than next Wednesday.
They were mandated to come out in July of 2012, so we've been waiting a while now.
Andrew Shepard is the director of the Gulf of Mexico University Research Collaborative.
We need to move ahead with planning, and we can't do it until we get these regulations out the door so that we can receive the funding necessary to do this.
Shepard gave a presentation on the situation in the Gulf to the Florida Association of Counties Gulf Consortium as they held their monthly meeting on Pensacola Beach this week.
What I was trying to get across was, number one, is that oil and gas activities are going to continue in the Gulf. They're going to continue to be deep, and they're going to continue to push towards the east, the Florida coastline, if they had the chance, because the resources are there. Secondly, that where are we at in terms of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill? What's the condition of things? What are areas of concern that we should continue to watch in terms of biology and the impacts of the oil spill? And then the last thing was to make some recommendations on areas that we think we need to continue to focus on. things like coordinating across all these restoration programs and pulling their information together.
The meeting on Pensacola Beach was chaired by Escambia County Commissioner Grover Robinson, who recently went to Washington with Senator Nelson to testify in front of the Senate Commerce Committee and, in the senator's words, give them a kick in the pants to get the regulations for distributing the oil spill money in accordance with the Restore Act. Robinson says they got that kick.
We clearly told them we needed the money for the planning. If they want restoration, we need to have planning done so that we can do the proper projects.
And once the money flows and restoration begins, the Gulf University Research Collaborative's Andrew Shepard says getting all of the states and counties affected by the oil spill on the same page looks to be an uphill battle.
It's close to impossible to do it without recognizing that they all have very different agendas and different missions. Okay, So just suffice to say that you're never going to make them all see things the same way. That's never going to happen. What you need to do, though, is get their resources moving in the same direction. Some of the programs are going to be directed through federal programs. Some of them are going to be through the states. These states have done a very good job, some better than others. As we heard in the meeting today, Louisiana, for example, already has a master plan that it's pointing to direct its programs and where it goes. Some of them are, like Florida, are waiting on the regulations from Treasury. So the first step is going to be to see everybody's plans and what they propose to do. And if we can all see the plans and find out where the overlaps are, find out where the gaps are, I think that'd be a huge step in making it all possible.
But before any of that can begin, all eyes and ears will remain on Washington, waiting for the regulations that will get the real work started. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Bob Barrett in Pensacola.
Well, as long as we're out in the Florida Panhandle, let's jump in the car and trek about 200 miles east on scenic U.S. 98 until we come to a once-thriving fishing village that's now in the throes of reinventing itself. A new craft beer brewery in coastal Apalachicola is a point of pride and an economic driver for a community that was hit hard by the oyster industry's recent decline. Jessica Palumbo visited the historic Panhandle town this week as the community celebrated the opening of Oyster City Brewing Company.
As National Oyster Day rolled around this year, Apalachicola had an extra reason to celebrate. On a downtown street lined with palm trees and restored old buildings, a band plays outside the tap room of Oyster City Brewing Company.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Enjoy them.
Thanks. Four beers are on tap next to giant metal tanks in the red brick-walled room.
We produce everything here. We make it on site and sell it to you, and there's just not a whole lot of that going on anymore.
For years, Oyster City co-owner Cassie Gary and her family have run a popular restaurant across the street and, more recently, the bar next to it. She says after so many customers asked what local beers they have on tap, the family found business partners and decided to make some of their own. It's been a nearly two-year process.
I mean, it literally takes a village to raise a brewery. We couldn't have done it without without the community has been amazing.
At tonight's grand opening, Gary says she's exhausted but feeling great. And that's despite national headlines that paint a bleak picture of a region that's depended on oysters for so long. With that industry's health at stake, an ongoing state lawsuit against Georgia seeks to force Florida's northern neighbor to increase the flow of fresh water into Apalachicola Bay. But Gary says locals find plenty to be hopeful about.
I don't feel like Appalachia's doing anything but growing stronger and getting better and figuring out ways to, you know, to create jobs that have been lost through the oyster industry.
Apalachicola Bay Chamber of Commerce President Anita Grove says the new brewery is a big part of that.
They've been employing more and more people every week. I come by and there's a new person. So they're actually creating jobs, and as they expand, they're going to be creating more jobs.
And though Oyster City's been operating for just months, it's the Central Panhandle's first craft brewery to get regional distribution. Tallahassee's Will Davis works for beverage distributor Tri-Eagle Sales. He says Oyster City came along at the right moment to satisfy what restaurant owners want.
Some great local seafood-style restaurants that are really, you know,
bringing in Apalachicola fresh seafood, and so they want to pair that with Apalachicola fresh beer.
In the past couple of months, Oyster City beers have found buyers from Pensacola to Destin to Tallahassee. Happy National Oyster Day, indeed. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
You're listening to Capitol Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida's legislature has returned to the Capitol to revise the state's congressional districts. We'll let you know exactly how all that turns out next week. But in the meantime, government workers make up a big part of Tallahassee's local economy. But as Nick Evans reports, the special session's impact is less than clear.
Last week, when Senate President Don Gates and House Speaker Will Weatherford called the legislature back to work, it threw lawmakers' summer plans into disarray. For some, like Naples Republican Representative Kathleen Pasadomo, it wasn't a big deal.
I practiced law, so I would have been in my law office doing some legal work.
Okay, so this is sort of a vacation.
Not really.
For others, it got in the way of vacation plans.
My husband and I actually had a trip planned to Portland, Oregon. He lectures, and he's lecturing this Saturday in Portland, and we were going to spend a couple extra days out there. I've never been there, so I'm really disappointed that I had to cancel the trip.
That's Lantana Democratic Representative Lori Berman. But on the bright side, lawmakers coming back to town could give Tallahassee a small economic boost. Some legislators maintain an apartment in town, but others go to hotels. That's what St. Petersburg Democratic Representative Dwight Dudley is doing.
I'm staying at Aloft.
But that's about as far as his economic footprint goes.
God. I mean, I packed my steel-cut oats and, have a little bag of groceries from home. We eat here in the house today. I think we're eating chicken.
Jonathan Brazier manages the hotel where Dudley is staying, and he says they haven't seen much impact. He thinks it has to do with the nature of a special session.
A special session typically calls back the actual legislatures themselves, and so it doesn't bring in as many out-of-town travelers as when we're in normal session.
But that's just the roof over one's head, and even lawmakers need to eat. So what about local watering holes?
Sure. My name is Matt Polis, and I'm the assistant general manager.
This is Madison Social. It's a restaurant close to the FSU campus that's probably more popular with legislative aides, but Tallahassee Representative Alan Williams did hold a fundraiser here last week. Polis says the legislative session directly affects the restaurant's bottom line.
Absolutely. Whenever the session is in, we definitely see an influx of young professional suits and, politically charged people come in, absolutely.
Paulus says they've only seen a small impact so far, but either way, they're going to make the most of it.
We have a drink called the Gerrymander, and it's Sailor Jerry, Mandarin Orange, and Ginger Beer.
As subcommittees in both houses passed draft proposals Friday, it seems clear lawmakers will make an impact on the map, even if their influence over the local economy is less clear. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Nick Evans, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. And join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust. Empowerment. Education. Employment. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.